This is the Regional Roundup. Good to have you with us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Delaware State University is moving to acquire Wesley College. DSU is an historically black university, which has been growing exponentially in recent years. We will speak with DSU President Tony Allen. Also, Jenny Rose Carey of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society will be along to answer your summer gardening questions. But to start, an extraordinarily tough year has become even more difficult for the city of Philadelphia. As officials grapple with the coronavirus and social unrest, the rate of gun violence has been steadily climbing and in recent weeks skyrocketing. 35 people were shot over the July 4th weekend alone, and at least 7 people died, including 2 children. Police say at least 900 people have been shot since New Year's Day, an increase of over 30% compared to the first half of last year, and the number of homicides is on the rise as well. Why is there significantly more gun violence now in Philadelphia, and when and how will residents of affected areas see relief? We are joined by Philadelphia City Council President Daryl Clark, and as always, Daryl, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning.
So, let's start with the numbers. Over 900 people shot since the beginning of the year, Daryl Clark. What do you think is happening?
Well, it's what we call the perfect storm in a very negative way. The simple reality is that Philadelphia has experienced significant levels of gun violence for years. This is not new, but the scope and the pace of it is very, very new. We haven't experienced numbers like this since, I think, 2006, 2007, when we surpassed 400. And we're on pace to surpass 400 homicides this year, unfortunately. We think a significant contributor to this is what's going on, the pandemic, this issue with respect to the aggressive downturn in the economy. We've lost way more than 100,000 jobs in a very short space in the city of Philadelphia. That's on top of the city of Philadelphia being the largest big city as it relates to the poverty numbers, 400,000 people living in poverty in this city, the social unrest. There are a whole lot of things that have contributed to these very aggressive numbers. There is one consistency as it relates to the homicide numbers. It's the ongoing issue as it relates to Harrisburg, the General Assembly, and the governor's office, not personalizing, but unwillingness to give us some reasonable gun laws that allows us to stop the proliferation of weapons in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, the city has had its hands tied by state law. Municipalities cannot enact their own laws regulating guns, including assault weapons. If Philadelphia were able to enact gun legislation, Daryl Clark, what would it look like ideally?
Well, we think the most significant one is the reporting of lost and stolen guns. We passed that law on the local level in 2008. We have since revived it. The district attorney recently moved forward on a press conference that talked about enforcing that particular law. We are currently in the court process as it relates to having that law enacted. We understandably got a response from gun rights individuals, and they are trying to stop this process. We genuinely believe that it's unlikely that we'll get support in the General Assembly in the state to pass this particular law. So we're trying to seek some relief in the court system. We want to actually get to the Supreme Court, where we were on path to do that some years ago. And we believe, like in other states, that they will see the reason that we need to have this in the city of Philadelphia. The realities of the city of Philadelphia and in the state, because these particular homicides are happening all over our state. So if we get relief in court, we will be able to enact lost and stolen. I like to talk about the fact that if you lose your car or somebody steals your car, you can't wait to pick up that phone and call the police.
Yeah.
If you lose your credit card, the first thing you're going to do is call the bank, tell them to put a stop on that credit card usage. So explain to me, if you lose your gun or somebody steals your gun, you should not report that. We believe that that will go a long way into stopping straw purchases. We're able to enact that particular legislation.
All right, let's get to the coronavirus, which blew a huge hole in the city budget. I don't have to tell you this, Daryl Clark. I think it's $750 million. Are anti-violence programs vulnerable?
Well, they are, given the fact that we've had to look at every aspect of our city budget. As you said, that hole was unlike anything we've ever seen. But we understood the need to continue to invest in programs that stop the level of violence in the city of Philadelphia. But more importantly, I believe that we've invested in programs that we think that will deal with the systemic issue as it relates to violence. We believe there's a direct nexus between violence, gun violence, and poverty. And the simple reality is that if people have meaningful opportunities, if people have meaningful jobs, if people have meaningful education that affords them an opportunity to achieve these goals, we think we will see a real reduction. If you look at the city of New York, a city that has traditionally had a relatively high level of employment opportunities, this year they had a reduction in all of those things as a result of the pandemic, and you've seen a very aggressive spike in their violence and gun violence numbers in the city of New York. So we think that we have to approach it from a long-term basis, but we're going to be working on a number of issues, focus deterrent, continue to have individuals on the street talking to people. But I think more importantly that at some point you really have to focus on providing opportunities to people that see no hope at the end of that particular tunnel. So
sure.
We're going to do it all.
So, Daryl, even though the city of Philadelphia is working its way through the green phase, you know, the effects of the pandemic will be with us for quite some time. So specifically, what can be done to ease the frustration and even despair caused by the ongoing unemployment crisis?
Well, we're looking at, in the city of Philadelphia, and actually working with a couple of our state and federal partners, of initiating some short-term relief as it relates to opportunities. We've had some research done by a number of consultants that talked about what we can likely put in place in terms of direct employment. In our poverty initiative, we laid out a number of things that we think we can do. And hopefully within about a week or two, we're going to be able to announce something that will be able to put people back to work, not necessarily in extremely high-paying jobs, but in jobs that give people some level of the ability to sustain their families. Hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, we'll be announcing that, and we're going to move forward with getting people back to work in the city. But we got to get them back to work safely, because we do not want to have another spike in our numbers.
Apparently in the spring, the city was planning to implement a strategy to reduce gun violence known as group violence intervention. The concept essentially was identify those who are likely to be shooters or victims, communicate with them, offer them services, training, etc., in an effort to help stem gun violence. Why has that been put on hold? Do you know offhand, and might it be put into place in the near future?
Yeah, well, it's directly related to resources. The simple reality is you don't close that type of gap without cutting back on a number of different issues across the board. But we anticipate being able to implement that program. Again, we did focus money on that after we revised our budget and went through the budget process in council. And we will be invested in people, because we believe that that, along with the ability to change the legislation in Harrisburg, are direct opportunities to change the level of violence in the city of Philadelphia.
There are, of course, new conversations happening around police reform across the country. Daryl Clark, what are constituents saying to you about the need for reform, but also, you know, the apparent need for a degree of police presence as illegal guns and shootings continue to cause so much pain? Is there a delicate dance here?
Well, you have to have a balance. The simple reality is you can't have a city where you have 219 homicides in early July and not have police available to make sure that we stem the tide of these numbers. But we also must make sure that people that don't need to be on the police department are weeded out in there. We put in a series of reforms that the mayor is supporting, and actually I'm told that the FOP president actually supports some of those measures. We will enact them. We believe that having a civilian oversight commission that has real teeth and subpoena power will go a long way in ensuring that we weed out those particular individuals. The administration has enacted certain measures, anti-bias training, oversight within the police department. We believe a residency clause should be a part of this reform to ensure that members of the police department not only reflect the demographics of the city on a racial level, but also understand the culture of the city. So all of those measures being in place, I think that we can perform and have a balanced approach to ensuring strong policing, supportive policing. Police should be a part of the community fabric. but ensure that we deal with this issue as it relates to police and community relations. You can't have a police at odds, department at odds with the local community. That just doesn't work.
According to published reports, many of the suspects in the shootings over the 4th of July weekend have not been arrested. What would you like to see the police department do to increase resolution of such cases?
Well, you know, this whole issue around the case closure, it's just been this ongoing discussion between the district attorney's office and the Philadelphia Police Department as to who is responsible for those closure rates. It's not in my lane, but I would like to see some closure. It's clear that there are some people who do not need to be on the street. They need to be brought to some significant and quick closure as it relates to their cases. Those family members of those individuals need closure. I like to see the police department and the district attorney's office get a much better relationship as it relates to moving forward. We can't have this ongoing debate about who's responsible for what. Finger pointing doesn't work from my perspective, but getting together and clearly understanding the need to make our city safe. So we're going to be looking at that. We're going to be having those conversations as we deal with this whole issue as it relates to violence.
Well, you know, reform obviously takes time, but those who are suffering from the effects of gun violence might well say, we don't have time. How do you respond to this? How do you think the city should respond to this?
Well, I agree. And a part of this has to do with everyone. I mean, you know, the simple reality is that the police department, you know, the elected officials cannot be the only solution. This is going to call for all people. And I do want to say that there are a lot of individuals. I've had conversations over the weekend with a number of the individuals that we're working with dealing with anti-violence initiatives. If we can come together, and I continue to hear from them that we must provide economic opportunities for individuals who are out on the street that have the level of despair and hopelessness that causes them to be involved in this very, very unfortunate situation. We have to address that issue. I mean, you talk to those individuals who talk to these people on a consistent basis, and they continue to pivot back to making sure that people have some opportunities. There are some people who will never do the right thing, and they need to be put away. I mean, this is a simple reality. Whatever is in their DNA has caused them to not want to be a part of our society. But there are so many people that I think, if given an opportunity, be it education, job opportunities, or whatever, simply the ability to talk to someone, will go a long way into stemming the tide. So we have to work together. We're prepared. We're getting ready to start a listening tour with a number of my colleagues, working along with some of the anti-violence organizations.
In the communities?
Yeah, in the communities. Okay. And they're going to do some of them virtually, but there are going to be some in-person conversations out there in the streets of Philadelphia. It's actually starting this week. So
we've
got to get a handle on this. You cannot continue to have a city where 300-plus homicides is an acceptable number.
And we will be in touch with you on that, Daryl Clark. Sorry, we're up against the clock. Daryl Clark is president of Philadelphia City Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Up next, Tony Allen is the head of Delaware State University, which is acquiring Wesley College. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Delaware State University has been breaking enrollment records for the past 10 years, and the historically black university's growth is likely to continue with the recent news of the acquisition of Wesley College in Dover. Wesley is a much smaller, private, liberal arts institution, which has been struggling financially. Both were founded in the late 19th century, and both institutions largely serve students of color, although the vision could be broadening. Delaware State University President Tony Allen says the mission is to make DSU a, quote, substantively diverse, contemporary, and unapologetically historically black college or university, end quote. So what might the DSU-Wesley deal bring to the table? We are joined by Delaware State University President Tony Allen. Welcome.
Hey, Mary, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing great.
So let's talk a bit about DSU's mission. Again, it is an historically black university. You say in a piece that was published on WHYY's site, quote, our North Star is to be the most diverse contemporary HBCU in the nation. Tell us more about that.
Sure. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here on such a great occasion. When I talk about our vision, it really takes it in three parts. When you think about who we are with respect to being substantively diverse, we already have a diverse array of offerings, about 104 in total. We also have a system of education. So we have our early childhood center, an early college high school, which is about 425 students, and obviously our core undergraduate and graduate programs. And we want to build on that substantively. I also think when you think about racial diversity, we are also one of the most diverse HBCUs in the country already. And we take great pride in that because we do see that is our opportunity to make sure that we can provide access to higher education for all. Contemporary just means that we want to provide real-world instruction in the 21st century America and do it in the way that our students learn. And unapologetic HBCU is critically important to who we are because we see that as a proxy for all those who have either been overlooked or underrepresented in higher education. And that is certainly African-Americans over the course of history, but there's other groups as well. I can tell you that more Dreamers, children of undocumented workers, choose Delaware State University more than any other college university in the country. So just making sure that we are targeting those students who have gotten to college sometimes by despite enormous odds, and give them a real opportunity to change the trajectory for themselves and their family.
How does Wesley fit into the picture?
You know, one of the real gems of our opportunity to due diligence with them was that we found that they are also a minority-serving institution, which is a federal designation. So when you put us side by side, you'll see that they have a very strong demographic as it relates to students of color. They have about 63% in total, and I'd say growing. Their student demographic from an academic portfolio is very similar to ours as well. And we have a good complement of programs between us. I'm particularly impressed with their occupational therapy program and their nursing program and education programs. And I see those and many others as a big complement to how we will grow, not only where we are, which is kind of in North Dover, but in downtown Dover, which we believe needs Delaware State as a central figure for its economic and cultural life.
So let's talk a little bit more about the situation Wesley is in at the moment. It is a private institution which has fallen on hard times in recent years. And state lawmakers, you know, gave Wesley, I think it's $6 million in funding over the past 2 years. Do you know what the thinking was and their thoughts and the value in keeping Wesley solvent, you know, state dollars in a private institution?
Well, you know, as you have seen, probably since the turn of the 21st century, there have been a lot of pressures on small private liberal arts colleges. That's not exclusive to Wesley. But in Dover, that's a 147-year tradition of providing really high-quality education for its students and, as I said, contributing to downtown Dover. So from my perspective, the opportunity for them to continue in some way was very, very important, not only for Dover, but for the state. I think many legislators realized that, wanted to make this original investment to see what would come to fore. They took their time trying to find the right partner, and ultimately I was watching them closely along with many members of the Delaware State University community, and we thought that we could be an ideal partner. There's still a couple of hurdles, as you know, for us to get over, one of which is to make sure we can get outside funding to continue to support the deal. But we feel pretty good, particularly given the initial reaction we've seen since last Thursday.
So the acquisition, Tony Allen, is happening as many institutes of higher education are facing crushing challenges because of the coronavirus. How has DSU worked around this?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things I said in my letter to the university community was a lot of folks might be thinking, why now? But I actually think that because the landscape is changing so rapidly, it's an important opportunity that we did not want to miss. So we do think that with respect to our own COVID planning, We've been very thoughtful, even as we think about the return of our students, staff, and faculty, and what needs to take place in order for them to be safe and continue the academic continuity that they believe is strong. And as we looked at Wesley, we thought that the two similarly situated, 2 miles away from each other, with a very, very similar student demographic, could be advantageous, certainly in the short term, but also over the long term, clearly. I can tell you that things like shared residence spaces, which we have not done before, but we will likely do as we move forward, the opportunity to increase the facilities and use of those facilities for a lot of our programs, also very attractive. And the Wesley brand, which has some equity, some significant equity, I'd say, in the Dover and Delaware landscape, those are all appealing to us. So this is a once-in-a-generation moment, and we did not want to lose the opportunity to grow our footprint substantively and serve more students, most importantly.
There's a pretty big difference in the tuition costs at the DSU and Wesley. How do you reconcile that? I mean, Wesley's a private, small college, and I think it's, what maybe 3 times as expensive?
That's about right. Right. And I can tell you that in this first year, it is a transition year, so you will see that Wesley and Delaware State University will still act independently as independent institutions. There are a couple of steps, one of which is getting approval from our regulatory body, which is the Middle States Commission on Higher Education. So it's going to take about a year to get to close. But once we get to close, and another good comparison point, about 57% of their students are in-state compared to 55% of ours. So those students will have an opportunity to get tuition at Delaware State University's tuition. What's interesting about that for Delawareans is if you're a graduating high school senior with a 2.75, the Inspire Scholarship, which was afforded us by the state legislature several years ago, is going to pay half your tuition for the full-time year at the university. So we see an opportunity to not only give a significant tuition benefit to our students, particularly those who would be incoming from Wesley, but also to grow the student base fairly significantly with the two institutions together.
So is the Inspire Scholarship, do you believe that this is one of the reasons that Delaware State University's enrollment has increased by 40% over the past decade?
One of the most significant, actually, Mary. It's a great point. There are 3 things we point to, one of which is the Inspire Scholarship, which, as I said, is really providing an uplift for our in-state students. The other one is our ability to really dip into the online space fairly early and to accelerate that over the past couple of years. And then our international portfolio has grown as well. We also have that early college high school I spoke to you about, which is basically a pipeline to Delaware State. So they are 9th through 12th graders who can earn up to 60 college credits before they're ever admitted into a college, which makes them usually a second semester sophomore, first semester junior upon arrival. And about 53% of them actually come to Delaware State. So those drivers have really been significant for us. And I think you may know this, but if you look at the broader college and universities market, while we've gone up 40% over the last 10 years, colleges and universities have declined in enrollment about 5.5% over that same period. So we are continuing to try to buck the trend and also turbo boost some of our opportunities here in the short term, and Wesley College is one good way to do that.
So the increase in enrollment also is unique during this time for HBCUs. With DSU success, do you think that this is other HBCUs might want to take a page from the playbook at DSU?
Well, you know, I look at it this way. My sister institutions in the HBCU community are tremendous. I always say, if you didn't have us, you'd have to invent us, just as it relates to the students we serve and how we serve them. I don't think there are many universities that can give the care and concern and the excellence in academic performance that HBCUs can do across the country. And a win for one of us is always a win for all of us. So whether it's Delaware State today or Bennett tomorrow or Lincoln the next day, we do believe that we can learn from each other, and I'm learning certainly from my colleagues all the time. So to the extent that this helps think about some opportunities in their respective communities. I appreciate that, but know that we are always learning from each other.
You were named president of Delaware State University, Tony Allen, in January of this year. Let's talk a little bit about your career path. You at one point, you know, in your career, you left an executive post with Bank of America to move forward to another job. How is your background in banking shaping DSU's future?
I don't know if it's actually shaping DSU's future as much as I'm bringing a different perspective to an enormous tradition of excellence and service. So when I think about Delaware State University and how I can help advance the institution's mission, it's really about making sure that we are telling the story that sometimes we haven't really told as boldly or loudly, and then taking advantage of the opportunities as they arise. You have to do that, obviously, with a sound eye toward good business management. You have to think about your risk tolerance. You have to build capacity going forward so you can support big decisions. And then you have to hold people accountable. And I've learned that throughout my career, not just at Bank of America, although that was a tremendous 15 years for me, but really throughout my career, whether it be at the Urban League in Wilmington or with the then Senator Biden, or even at Public Allies, where I first started my career. All those opportunities in the private, public, and nonprofit sector gave me an opportunity to see real moments of change from very different perspectives, and then bring those sort of as a nexus point to Delaware State at an important
I just asked because I don't mean to jump in because I'm looking at the clock and we're running
sure.
a little short, but I'd ask because I saw in published reports that as provost, you'd, quote, developed a plan to increase the university's annual research portfolio from $20 million to $35 million over the next 5 to 7 years. So I just thought I would wondered if there was a connection.
Yeah, you know, there was almost no research portfolio 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So, again, we're just trying to turbo boost where we know the natural areas of strength are. And that plan is still in place. And I can say, thankfully, that the program is growing successfully from a research portfolio standpoint.
Tony Allen, back to Wesley for a moment. Any word
sure.
yet as to whether Wesley's professors might be kept on?
You know, we're looking at all talent, not just their professors, but certainly those folks as well. And as you know, in these type of opportunities, what you don't want to do is presuppose what you're going to do relative to who you keep and who you move on from. You take a very hard look at what I think is a talented group of professionals. You match them with your own professionals, and you try to make the best decisions moving forward. So there's a lot of time for us to think through how best to do that. But you can count on us doing that in earnest over the next year.
And you'd also mentioned a little bit earlier that you are looking for some outside funding in order for this deal to be successful, correct?
We are. We look at it as a three-year time horizon for us. But we have, again, had very positive response, really even before we announced the deal on Thursday. So we see the opportunity to support it as a very promising as we move forward here. So I'm looking forward to making some more announcements as we get into this year and over the next couple of years on that score.
Okay, let's get back to the coronavirus and Delaware State University. What is the specific plan for the fall? Is it a hybrid? Is it more online, more in class? What does it look like at this point?
So that's a great question. We actually announced our reopening plan Tuesday before we announced the Wesley deal last Thursday. And at the heart of our reopening plan is testing. We have a relationship with Testing for America, which has been a significant advisor for us and is populated by a number of subject matter experts around the country. And what we've done is develop a full testing protocol. So what that means is not only will you be tested prior to your arrival, but on your arrival and then throughout the semester from a random sample. And that is for faculty, staff, and students. Relative to learning, we will be in a hybrid learning environment. We're going to bring about 75% of our student body back on campus with all the protocols you might think would be in place relative to social distancing and wearing masks. But most of the environment would be hybrid. And we think about 85% of our courses can be taught in that hybrid context. So that gives us enough opportunity to make sure that our students are safe, our staff and faculty feel comfortable. And because of the testing protocol, we can certainly figure out who has tested positive. We have actually a residence hall that's only for quarantine, so it can make those changes in real time until there's a vaccine.
So as we've seen across the country, Tony Allen, you know, young people have been getting together, they've been going to the beach and et cetera, and they are a driver of the rise in the coronavirus. So on, you know, as in other college campuses, how does Delaware State University plan to handle the question of student get-togethers, of parties, of concerts, or whatever might be available amidst the restrictions?
You know, I can tell you that as we think about the gatherings as it relates to student activities, I've talked to my student government leader several times throughout the semester and through the summer, and I can tell you that they understand that it has to be different. There have to be much more virtual opportunities for them to engage. And even with the Testing for America program, at the heart of that program is participation from the university community, particularly students. So we're trying to make sure that everybody understands that we're in this together. To make it successful, we have to build even more sensitive and stronger community around these issues. And the best way to do that is not for me to declare from on high, but to make sure that everybody's involved in the process. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Okay, one more quick question. Fall sports, the Hornets, off the table for the fall semester?
Not at this time. Actually, that's a dynamic question, changing constantly around the country. We're certainly watching all the trends and speaking to our conference officials. But at the moment, we are still pushing forward with fall sports.
Okay. Tony Allen, president of Delaware State University. It was a pleasure.
Hey, thank you for the time. Appreciate it, Mary.
Thank you. Take care. And coming up next, as we wrap up the regional roundup for today, Jenny Rose Carey of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society is along to answer your gardening questions. So if you have any questions, comments, or anything else you'd like to add to the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We are here for you. Stay with us. You are listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the remainder of the hour, we're going to be talking about summer gardening. The freshness of spring is way behind us, and though there's plenty of fun and gorgeous growing time ahead, there is just more to contend with this time of year. The heat, the weeds, too much water, not enough water, and pests, including the reemergence of the voracious spotted lanternfly. It is capable of destroying vineyards, orchards, various trees, and more, and costs Pennsylvania's economy an estimated $50 million a year. If you have questions or comments about anything related to the garden, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or send along a comment, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jenny Rose Carey is Senior Fellow in Horticulture at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. And Jenny, as always, such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
So let's begin with the lanternfly. It is on the move again. Jenny, as we know, it's been spreading steadily since it was first discovered in Berks County 6 years ago. Have you seen it where you are at Meadowbrook Farm in Jenkintown?
Yes, we've seen it all in the north. I've mostly been in my home garden in Ambler. But all of this north part of the city, we've had a lot of sightings of it. And, all the social media is full of what is this nasty thing that's invading my garden. So, yes, I think it's throughout the region. I believe it's been here, I think they first spotted it down near Drexel about probably a month ago. But it's for those that don't know, it has a different state. It starts with a little tiny nymph. What you're looking for is something very odd looking that's black with white spots. And then when it gets to basically like a lot of insects, it changes shape, which is everybody. And then it gets to the late nymph, and that is red as well as black and white. So it sort of looks triangular in shape. And then by the fall, you'll see the adults, which are sort of buffy beige color with black spots and then red on the underneath wings. And they are called plant hoppers, but the later ones do have wings, the adult ones. And then they spend the winter on trees and on your decks and on your pool equipment, on anything hard surface that they can lay clusters of eggs. So they really have invaded, and we're up to early and late nymphs at the moment. That's okay. What you should be looking at.
So how do we kill them? No mercy with the lanternfly.
Oh,
right?
I know. There's a trouble here because, you know, some people want to just go out and spray insecticides. They are an insect, so yes, that would work. Our problem we have with that is most of the time that's near your house. It's near where your children are playing and your children are home, and your dog plays and your cat is out there or whatever. So we also are worried about how many pollinators are around in the world. And obviously, if you spray an insecticide, you will kill butterflies, you will kill bees, which are, you know, on pretty much every flower right now. And they're the big bumblebees, they're the honeybees, they're all the different types of bees, and the little tiny pollinators as well. So that sort of fairly indiscriminate use of insecticides is not something that we recommend. But, you know, boy, they're causing so much economic damage. If you're a farmer, you're just like, oh, my goodness, especially grapevines, as you said, and some of the hardwood trees. So we have to do something, and we have to play our part.
So squish them, vacuum them.
Squish them. yes, all of the above. Yes, any method that you can try. You know, a fly swat works, and there's like those tennis racket ones, I think, that you can get that like a bug zapper that you can try. The problem is that they, at the moment, are hopping, and they, in the heat of the day, they're harder to catch. Go out early in the morning, late at night, if it does cool down, and they are a tiny bit slower then. You can clap your hands over them if you don't mind, or wear gloves to do that. They are going to hop towards you, which can be a bit scary, but the other way you can do it is get an old bottle. I've got an old, what does it have, peanuts in it or something like that. I put soapy water in the bottom, and if you angle it the right way, they'll actually hop into your jar. And then my husband was out with his portable, you know, the vacuum cleaner that you clean the car out with, you know, portable vacuum, and that works really well. You have to have a little bit of damage, is what we call collateral damage, happens when you're doing that, because you might suck some leaves in as well. But we used it last fall up and down the tree trunks, because the adults by September are going to be crawling up the tree trunk. That's actually much easier to get them with the back. But you can try that, and he had great success, and it was also a fun activity for some teenagers or preteens to go around your yard and look for them, because they're very visible, the black and white and red, you know.
If there's a bored teen, give them the vacuum, the port-a-vac.
But expect a little damage on the process, because even my husband was like, whoops.
Okay. Well, listen, one more question on the spotted lanternfly before we move on. Charlie asks, does the spotted lanternfly harm birch trees?
Yes, I saw them on. Charlie, yes, I think it sucks. It's not one of the ones that I think is online. And please go to the Pennsylvania, if you're in Pennsylvania, it doesn't matter, but that's the best site I've seen so far for it, is the Department of Agriculture site. That has a lot of information, and they're also having an online webinar on Wednesday evening that you can sign up for about it, if it's really something that you're interested in. I think it's 7 o'clock Wednesday the 15th. But I have some new river birches that I planted a few years ago, and they were crawling all up there. And for those that don't know, the adult is a sap sucker. So what does that mean? It means that they are going to insert their mouth parts into the tree, and they're a messy sap sucker. So some of it comes out of various places on the insect, and then it causes the honeydew to drip down, which is sticky, and then you get the black mold. So all in all, it's a bad news, bad bug, as they call it.
Yeah. So. Well, all right. Speaking of pests, we have a tweet from a listener who says, I'm having a terrible time with Japanese beetles. Is it a bad year, or have they just found our rose bushes? And I ditto that. I'm having a nasty year with Japanese beetles on the rose bushes. And you know, there are a number of ways, of course, to deal with it. I guess you can use an insecticide, but as you said, pollinators are out. Are there other ways to deal with this pest, which can just tear roses down in a matter of, it seems like a matter of minutes?
So, again, your best time to do any of these controls are in the morning. And, again, that same bottle with the water and the dish soap in, I used yesterday for the, you know, for the Japanese beetles as well as the spotted lanternfly. And they're almost easier to catch than the spotted lanternfly. And you just get the lid of your jar and use that to sort of wipe them in. And if it's cold, they won't fly away before you can get them. If you do it at noon, they'll probably go. I mean, again, it's squishing, it's catching. I mean, we always used to use those pheromone lures, but then I think you've got all your neighbors' Japanese beetles as well. There are longer-term things that you can do, which if you have a bad problem is like the milky spore that you might have heard of, and nematodes are also good. They're non-toxic to other things, especially the milky spore. You can put it on your lawn grass in a pattern, and it's really a longer-term solution. So in the meantime, you get to see which things the Japanese beetles or the spotted lanternfly prefer. And they're almost like your trap crops, unfortunately. And roses I love. Obviously, my middle name is Rose. Mm. So I just go out early in the morning with my jar, and it's a little bit satisfying, I think, to do a count, you know, and report. Okay. This is a bit soul-destroying, I have to say. But the more we all try and, you know, get rid of them, hopefully in the long run, they won't be as bad.
Well, let's get to we've got calls and comments coming in to Radio Times at WHYY.org. That's our email. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John tweets, my tomatoes are dying. I think it's a combination of wilt and early blight. How can I clean the soil in my raised bed?
Oh, dear. Oh, that's early for that. But we have had weird weather. Tomatoes and a lot of the vegetable crops really want a consistent moisture. So for those of you who are growing tomatoes, really, first of all, make sure that you are keeping that soil relatively consistently moist. Water in the morning, water the soil, that applies, you know, because we've got to do deep summer watering now. It's a different way of watering. And water the soil, not the plants. And then also remove the lower foliage on your tomato plants because then the soil-borne things that are coming out of the soil don't splash up.
Interesting.
And thin out. You can thin out, you know, in the leaf axils where the leaf meets the stem, there's another shoot that comes out. You can thin out that just with your thumb and forefinger and reduce the overall canopy a little bit. It helps some of the fruit to ripen. But for your listener that has got the problems already, I think the main thing is it's a long-term solution. We all know, I think, about crop rotation. And if you're growing veggies, one of the best ways to sort of reduce the amount of pests and diseases for a particular crop is to have different raised beds or different bits of the garden that you move your crop year to year. So if you've been growing your tomatoes in the same place every year, unfortunately, the soil-borne diseases grow up in the soil from year to year, build up. And so you might have a problem that is left over from last year.
Hopefully that helps, John. I didn't mean to interrupt, Jenny. One more quick question about tomatoes before we move forward. Dark rotting spots at the bottom of the fruit, seeing that already.
Yeah, that's blossom end rot. And I think it's a calcium deficiency. So look at your, again, goes back to the soil. Pretty much any gardening question you can ask me has to do with the soil. It really turns out that's true. So there are sprays that you can get that are perfectly harmless that will that are particularly marked for blossom end rot, and you can try and see whether you can, you know, get the next crop, next group of tomatoes to be better. But again, back to the soil. When you do your crop rotation in the long run, I gather that this isn't going to help you right now, but also add compost. Add any compost that you can make. Add leaf mold, add all of that good, yummy, organic stuff back into the soil, because the microbial life in the soil is going to be what helps you with all of these problems of your plants. It's just the most, you know, like the old ways are the best ways, back to the old composting and improving your soil.
Okay. Comment from Gail. Birds, bats, and small mammals are getting caught in the sticky tapes that people are putting around their trees to catch the lantern flies. The poor things are dying terrible deaths. Penn State Extension has recommendations to modify the tape to prevent this. Thoughts?
Yep. Okay. So we, in my garden here at Northview, have done a sort of modified version. There are things you can find online. I mean, if they say put duct tape inside out and that sort of thing to trap them, because as the adults in the fall climb up the trees, and actually some of the nymphs do as well, you can trap a lot of them. What we've done is make a plastic shield around over the tape so that the animals and birds don't get trapped in it. But that's a very good point. Thank you for raising that. But there's ways online. So it's like a... You still have the sticky stuff against the trunk of the tree, but we use some, you know, like foamy stuff to stop it sticking, the shield bit sticking from, for the birds and things like that. It's a little tricky, I have to say, but, you know, you're all inventive. And again, get your teenagers to figure it out. How are we going to stop our birds and bats getting stuck on the tree, but we still want to catch the nymphs, you know? And a lot of these... inventions and things that, you know, come out of somebody's good brain that helps stop them. So thinking.
There's certainly time for creativity recently.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Art project / science project all in one.
Quick question from Joe from Philadelphia. He wants to know if the lantern fly can harm you humans as well.
No, it's fine. I mean, they're pretty gross, I have to say. One jumped on my shirt yesterday and one jumped on my hat and everything. And you're like, so it's a bit more like a bit of a gross factor. No, they don't suck our blood. Luckily, they just suck the goodness out of your plants. So, no, you're safe, Joe. You're good.
Quick question about hydrangeas, Jenny. It can be tough to get some varieties to bloom year to year, but this year... Some which have been dormant for a long time seem to be flowering. Could our super mild winter have had something to do with this?
Oh, yes. That's a very good point. Good reasoning there. Yes, it did. Unfortunately, some areas had a bit of a late frost. I was worried about mine. But, you know, we're right on the border, the further north in the listening area that you go, we're right on the border for some of them. But, yes, we had that amazingly mild winter. So, the buds on hydrangeas, as with many other flowering shrubs and trees, form the year before, apart from on some of our native hydrangeas, which will bloom whatever. So look for some of the native ones, which are, you know, tough and adapted to our climate. And then if you want the traditional mophead or lace cap ones, look for ones that will bloom on old and new wood. The classic one now has become classic only a few years, is the Endless Summer range of hydrangeas. And they bloom both on the old wood that was formed last year, and they will bloom less vigorously, but they will bloom on the new wood as well. So if you're having trouble with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got one of those. They are very easy care. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We could have gone an hour with this conversation. But thank you, Jenny. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Such a help to have you with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jenny Rose Carey is Senior Fellow in Horticulture at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from you on social media. WHYY.org/Radio Times is where you go. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. John Ahrens is producer for the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us. Be well.